Gerald Newman is on.
Hi, Gerald. It's Ann.
Hey, Ann. Welcome.
Rick Wiesner here.
Hey, Rick.
Rick.
Stephanie Hendrickson.
Hey, Stephanie.
Yeah.
Hey.
Dana Abernathy.
I'm sorry, who?
Dana Abernathy.
Hey, Dana. Welcome.
Hey, Steph. Doing.
We may do the FEI part first. Who joined?
Dinah.
Hey, Dinah, welcome.
Thank you.
Kathleen Crandall hasn't yet joined, I don't think. I got an email from Anna Wolf saying she hadn't gotten my reminder.
Her membership just came in the mail today, so she's planning to be here.
I think I got the reminder.
I know she was on my list.
I got the reminder, and her name was on the two on the reminder.
Who joined?
Leanne.
Hey, Leanne.
Oh, hey, Leanne.
Hey.
Kathleen hasn't yet joined.
Okay.
So we're kind of waiting on her at the moment.
Yeah.
Okay, who else is on here?
Who joined?
Peter Franklin.
Hey, Peter, welcome.
Hey.
Good evening.
The rundown that I have thus far is Stephanie Hendrickson, Ann Ayala, Dana Abernathy, Rick Wiesner. Rick, is that right?
It's actually pronounced Wiesner, though he's pronounced A.
Wiesner.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
I had a feeling I was mutilating it.
Well, I'm used to it.
Anna Rojak, Leanne Pulley, Peter Franklin, and who just joined?
Anna.
Hey.
Anna Wolf.
Welcome, Anna.
Thank you.
We were just talking about you and in a sort of half panic mode trying to send you the information on the call.
Oh, I found it.
Good. We're waiting for our nutrition expert.
Oh, good.
Well, we're waiting for...
If anybody has any questions or anything they want to go ahead with, feel free.
I'll recommend a book.
Stag has been advocating this book. It's $75 a book per pop.
Well, it depends on what you can find it. You have to find it through Amazon.com, used books, or eBay or whatever. But it's a book called Horses of the Sahara. And it was written by a French general who was basically like the commandant or whatever of Algeria in the 1850s.
Who joined?
Hello? Kathleen.
You. Oh.
Yay!
Anyway, I will finish very quickly, so we can turn it over to Kathleen. But anyway, he developed the confidence of the Arabs, and so he tried to capture all the equestrian knowledge and secrets and all of the Arabs, who, of course, at the time were considered the best horsemen and had the best horses. Perhaps the most important insight is their culture. Money spent on your horses was one of the highest forms of alms that you could give, equivalent to giving directly to the mosque. And time spent on your horses was one of the highest forms of worship. So we should all be in good shape. And I will shut up and turn the floor over to Kathleen.
And Kathleen, rather than having it go directly to you, let me do a quick introduction. I want to, first of all, welcome you and the other full members who are on the call. And typically people do join the call sort of in an ongoing way at some level. And I'll try to capture names as we proceed. But I first of all want to thank Kathleen for joining us. Kathleen has been with Kentucky Equine, KER, Kentucky Equine Research.
That's right.
For a number of years, and also associated with Virginia Tech, all involved in equine nutrition. She's got a PhD in the field. Apex has been fortunate enough to have about a year ago, Kathleen, come to talk to us down in Georgia about equine nutrition vis-a-vis endurance. And at the same time, at least the half-life of my memory is such that by this time I've forgotten 99% of what she talked to us about. And so I imagine other people have at least somewhat similar types of memory lapses. And there's just so much to know and learn that I'm just going to ask everybody to pitch in as you have your questions. And we have a set of questions that I forwarded. And, Kathleen, I hope you got them.
Yes, I did.
Great. That I had received earlier, and I know Stag had a bunch of questions that he was supposed to give me, and we never did get them. So,
oops, I thought I did. Oh, well.
Yeah, so you did verbally, but not email-wise. And verbally is in one ear and out the other, as you know. Anyhow, Kathleen, and Deborah Rich sent in a whole bunch of questions, and at the same time, let's start with hers, even though she's not on. Or do you want to start? Kathleen, let me just turn it over to you, and then I'll just make sure that the questions get sort of addressed.
Okay. Well, the questions I did receive, well, thank you very much for the introduction. I appreciate the kind words. But the questions I did get were one about hoof supplements, biotin, and then also the amino acids, and then some recommendations for endurance horses on vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, protein, alfalfa, beet pulp, and corn.
Yeah.
So I suppose I probably should start with talking about the question on the methionine in hoof supplements. The concern was that I'm not sure who sent this in, but that one of the members had seen an article on biotin and how important it is for hooves and healthy hooves and how useful it can be for improving hoof condition. But the question was why wasn't methionine mentioned in that article, and why such a focus on biotin? And I have to say that yes, I think there's a whole lot of pieces to the puzzle of what makes a healthy hoof, and methionine is definitely important. But perhaps looking at it a little bit more of the grand picture of hoof nutrition, that there are many nutrients that are important, but the hoof is like 98% or 99% protein. And the protein that's used to build that hoof wall, it's like very similar to our nails, it's protein deposition. But the majority of the proteins are actually built up of amino acids, and these amino acids are like little building blocks of those proteins. And the one that's probably the most prominent in the hoof is called cysteine. And this amino acid cysteine is one of the sulfur-containing amino acids. And it's like a sister to methionine. And the body can take methionine and convert it to cysteine. So this is how, and if anybody has any questions, please chime in. But this is the link between protein and methionine. Why you might see methionine in a hoof supplement. If the body is protein deficient, you're going to eventually see that in the hoof because the body doesn't have enough extra protein to have good, healthy hoof walls. So a good balanced diet with sufficient protein is important for hoof care before you even think about hoof supplements. The other thing you can see a protein-deficient diet, I mean, you can also see in the hair coat, too, not only just the hooves. There, in the horse, we've only really kind of narrowed down, limited the essential amino acids, which are ones that have to be fed in order for the horse to get them. The horse can make build certain amino acids from building blocks in the body, but there are a few of them that are essential. And in humans and pigs and other animals, there are quite a few essential ones that you have to get from your diet. But in the horse, it's been really hard to kind of define what is essential. And lysine, I'm sure everybody's heard of lysine. Lysine is one of those that is essential. And the other things that they kind of pointed to was threonine and was another amino acid that is essential. But there's quite a number of them, and all the rest, if the body has the right building blocks, it can make them. So methionine doesn't really fall into those essential amino acids for the horse, as researchers have yet discovered. But it truly may be important to have it as a part of the diet, just to make sure that the horse does get enough. I mean, theoretically, the horse could make enough methionine, but maybe he's not, particularly if he's not getting enough protein in the diet. So if I was going to look for a hoof supplement, I would, biotin, of course, is important. But I would also look that it would have methionine in it. Does that answer the question on that?
Kathleen, what you said raised the following question in my mind. But take a horse that's out in the wild.
Uh-huh.
Is their principal source of the proteins that they use to turn into hoof material, just assume it's in the grass as they graze?
Yes. If you look at the grass, you look at protein content of grasses, it can range anywhere from, well, pretty low. I mean, if you look at it right now where you see nothing but brown grass, you know, you're looking at pretty low protein content. But in the summertime, it can be as high as like 28% dry matter. So, I mean, if you took all the water out, 28% of that's protein. So there's definitely proteins. That's the major source of protein for the horse. Not only in the wild, but our horses, they're getting the majority of their protein from the forage in their diet.
So does the protein, this is, you know, like the really dumb question, sorry. Does the protein itself typically have in it the amino acids, or are the amino acids bound to the protein, or are they separate beasts entirely? Is the protein an enabler for their binding?
Proteins are huge molecules, and they're made up of little amino acids.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and every protein is unique, or type of protein is unique to the build. What makes it unique is the buildup of the combination of those amino acids. So they're like if you had, it's like the building blocks. Like you had if you were a kid and you had a bunch of blocks and you made a tower, the amino acids would be each of those blocks, and the tower would be the protein.
Okay.
And so,
cysteine, methionine would all be at some level in at least one or more flavors of protein.
Yes. They're going to be in some type, You can find those methionines in this. And like I say, the body can take the amino acid, a methionine amino acid, and just modify the configuration of that amino acid and turn it into cysteine. Yeah, there's just like, I don't know how much biochemistry anybody's had, but you add an oxygen here, you add a hydrogen there, or like methionine and cysteine or sulfur-containing amino acids. So you're adding a sulfur to it, and that's what makes it different from maybe one of the other amino acids. So just add one little piece to the molecule will change the nature of that amino acid.
Mm-hmm.
So the body can actually do that for the animal to a certain degree.
Again, on the dumb question end of things, is there a reason for feeding something like methionine rather than feeding cysteine, or is cysteine just something that doesn't come in food?
That's a good question, and I'm not 100% sure on that. It could be the ability to make the amino acids, because as it is right now, most of our amino acids if you buy an individual amino acid, it comes from manufacturers in Japan. And there are to make a pure methionine probably is much cheaper, much simpler than making a pure cysteine.
Okay.
And so that's probably why that's what you see in the info supplement.
Tom
Gower was the one who asked these questions about.
Who did? I'm sorry.
Tom Gower had asked the questions about the hoof supplements. He's also not on.
He's not on. Oh, wonderful.
Who just joined?
Tom Gower just joined.
Oh, guess what? We were just talking about you. We're in the midst of discussing hoof supplements.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And Kathleen was explaining to me about amino acids building up for proteins.
Yeah, Tom, given his background, probably...
He knows all this stuff.
Knows what amino acids are all about, so maybe Kathleen could just do a quick summary for Tom of...
Okay.
Sorry, Kathleen.
No, not at all. Okay, well, maybe you could phrase your question how you really... You just want to know why there's little emphasis on the methionine.
Well, I can't even remember how I came across this, but... I was reading some article, I think it was on thehorse.com, about the value of biotin.
Right.
And it was written by some vet somewhere, and I forwarded it on to Cheryl and Stagg, saying I was surprised it didn't mention methionine, because I'm pretty sure I've heard Jeff Pauly say it's not one or the other, it's the ratio of the two. And I suspect that's pretty much true for all electrolytes and everything else. It's not just... a single one. It's always this balanced ratio of everything. So that was the basis of the question.
Okay. Well, there's a little bit of a difference. Biotin is actually a B vitamin, and so it's a vitamin. And methionine is an amino acid, so it's a part of a building block of protein.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are different animals, but they're both important in the hoof. Okay. And yeah, the article kind of focused on biotin because that's what a lot of researchers have pulled out and singled out of something that might improve hoof integrity and done research on it. Methionine, there are fewer studies on that, but what I was saying earlier is the hoof is it's mostly made of protein, and, you know, proteins are... amino acids are the building block.
Building block, sure.
A protein. So it's actually 93%. I was trying to remember exactly, but 93% protein. And methionine is just one of the proteins you might find in it. But what you find the most of is cysteine in the hoof.
Is this cysteine?
Cysteine, yes.
Uh-huh.
But the body can convert methionine to cysteine.
Okay.
And so
that's not the rate-limiting step.
Yeah. So, when you provide enough methionine, then if the body needs a cysteine, it just makes it from the methionine. But being 93% protein, you can see that having enough protein in the diet is really important for good hoof quality. And also having enough of these sulfur-containing amino acids in the diet would be important for hoof quality.
Uh-huh. So do we know enough to make some recommendations of the ratios of biotin to methionine that should be in a high-quality hoof supplement?
I don't think that there's we do have recommendations for biotin, and you probably saw there's an article that the studies that have been done. Did somebody just come on?
Yes, Deborah, hi.
Hi, hello.
Deborah.
Hi.
The studies that have been done with biotin, for example, they use either 15 milligrams or 20 milligrams of biotin per day.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the ones, not every study has shown in results, but the ones that have shown improvement, those were the levels that were used.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, that's pretty clear on biotin. And those are well above what the minimum requirement for biotin for the horse is,
uh-huh.
Which is only about, I think it's 1 to 2 milligrams a day. And so you can see these are like therapeutic amounts of biotin that actually help with hoof quality.
Yeah.
So they're not, there's not really, because that's a B vitamin and the other is amino acids. I don't think there needs to be concern about ratios.
Okay. But I'm just amazed when you start reading the labels. I think Farnam makes some sort of hoof supplement. I can't remember what it was. Farrier's Favorite or something. I can't remember. That has a very low methionine to biotin. Jeff Pauley's, I know, was real keen on the is it Hoof Power, I think, made by
Delta.
I know you get it from Centaur Forge, but what?
Delta.
Yeah, and that has even higher. And then some of you guys may or may everybody knows Dr. Beecher.
Uh-huh.
He's got some local guy making something up at the mill, and that has probably four times more methionine than what's in Hoof Power. So it's really, I've seen a tenfold range in that ratio of biotin to methionine.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because there really hasn't been enough work on methionine to pinpoint what would be that minimum requirement, because
uh-huh.
since the body can actually make it, there's it's not an essential amino acid, as they call
uh-huh.
it. The body, their essential amino acids are the ones that you have to actually eat.
Right.
And methionine is not one of those essential ones.
Hmm.
Okay. So I think it's, when you see these different levels and different supplements, it's anybody's guess as to what's the right amount.
Right, okay.
Kathleen?
Yeah.
Tom, did I interrupt you? Go ahead.
No, I'm through. I didn't mean to dominate the conversation, but
that's good. And so so what you might be looking for was, you're going to get the most for your money. You know, the one that has at least 15 to 20 milligrams of biotin, and then the most methionine for the supplement that has that that amount of biotin.
Okay.
I this is Dinah. I have a quick question on this subject.
Okay.
Oh, Kathleen, what do you think about old-fashioned gelatin?
Mm. Old-fashioned gelatin. Well, there was actually a study done back in 1977 by Dr. Hintz, and he looked at the effects of gelatin in ponies, growing horses, and he found that it didn't have any effect on hoof growth or quality. And let's see. And another study, I think, before that in the early 70s that also, again, didn't show any effect of gelatin. Now, I know that humans use it to improve quality of nail, so theoretically you'd think it should work, but, again, there just hasn't been any proof.
And has there been, in your mind, enough proof on methionine and biotin?
In my mind, the biotin, yes. I think there have been enough studies that have showed positive results. And again, with the methionine, I think there has been enough work. Conan in Germany did some work on methionine, and he did show that that there was a suggestion that it did improve. The other thing is zinc is another nutrient important, copper and zinc. Conan also did some work with the zinc, and he found some suggestion that a zinc deficiency, you could see problems in horse hooves, and that horses that had met the requirement for zinc in the diet or a little bit higher, they had intended to have better quality hoof. So those would be the things I would look for in a supplement, would be methionine, biotin, and zinc, and then copper, just to keep the zinc and copper within a good balance of a ratio.
Are we talking just about hoof vitamins or in general?
Just hoof at the moment.
Yeah, we'll get beyond hoof. One, in terms of, and we said earlier that a horse in the wild that's grazing, tend to have good hoof if they're not malnourished.
Uh-huh.
So in our horses, does hay, for example, have less of the desirable proteins that the horses could construct hoof material from than, say, if they're on a natural grass diet? Does it deteriorate?
Yes. When you cut it and you dry it, you do lose some things. I mean, if you took a grass that was 28% protein and cut it and dried it, by the time it's finished being made into hay, it'd probably be down to 15-18% protein. So there is some protein loss when you do make hay out of it. Some of our hays that we commonly feed the horses, Timothy. I have seen analysis of Timothy that had proteins as low as 6%. Now, if the horse is eating large quantities of it, okay, then he's getting more protein. He's eating small quantities, not getting very much. So, yeah, we could in our horses by feeding them on a strictly hay diet. Now, not if it's got alfalfa in it, because that's even higher in protein than most grasses. But yeah, we could have a protein issue.
Okay, that's what I was trying to understand, is how much do we need to supplement, because, you know, there are things where we are asking our horses to do things that where they clearly need, like, more energy than they might get just from normal grass and hay, so we add grain.
Mm-hmm.
Really trying to understand how much it supplement of the horses on a good diet in the first place.
Well, it came up this past weekend. Remember, Jeannie Waldron said to us all to give them as much fat as we could, but I'm not sure what the best way is to do that.
Okay, so fat and protein are different nutrients. Okay, so we don't want to confuse protein. When you're feeding a horse protein, it's for building blocks. So hoofs, the basis of hoof material, the basis of the muscle, the basis of most of the body. If you took out the water and the fat out of a horse's body, 80% of what's left is protein. So that protein is there to replace and help build tissues for the horse. Fat, when she's talking about oil, adding fat to the diet, she's talking about energy sources, calories,
okay,
for the horse to be able to do the work that it needs to do. And some of the energy sources, that the horse can get energy from different places, so fat being one of them. But a horse can also get energy from the breakdown of fiber, which is the breakdown of the hay and grass, and that's why wild horses survive, because they have the ability to get calories out of that grass. And then they can get calories from some of our grains, like corn and oats and barley. And they can get the protein. If you have way too much protein in the diet, the body can break it down and use it for energy. But that's not the ideal. I mean, there has been research done on feeding excessive protein, and it is detrimental, may not be the right word, but they saw a decrease in performance when they fed excessive protein to horses.
Can you repeat that? I didn't hear that.
Okay, so if you're feeding way too much protein, the body can break it down and use that excess protein for energy.
Now, when you say too much, you're talking like 20% or something, or
above the, yeah, whatever the requirement is.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's excess vis-a-vis whatever it is that horse is supposed to be doing. Or
yeah. Let's see. Okay. So if you're feeding a horse a diet of, I think some of these studies were like 30% protein, the total diet was 30% protein and 25% protein. These horses performed worse than horses that were fed a diet which was 12 or what is might be the requirement or the normal for that horse. So I'm talking, you know, large amounts of protein. And protein is just not an efficient energy source for an animal, a working animal.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd agree that high fat is a good idea, and then I guess the question is, where are they? Should they get it from rice bran oil or?
Okay, high fat is a good idea. There's many sources of fat. Rice bran itself is 20% fat, so that's a good way to get some extra calories into the horse. Some of the oils, like canola oil, corn oil used to be a very common thing to be added into the horse's diet. I think with recent studies that have been done on omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids, it's come to light that maybe corn oil is not the best, although it's the tastiest and one the horses like to eat the most. The corn oil is probably not the best for our horses. There's canola. There's soybean oil is okay. Linseed, flax oil, but not in huge quantities.
How about
rice bran oil is okay, but it can be really expensive if you're trying to feed large quantities.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Rice bran oil probably can be pretty expensive if you're trying to feed large quantities. It's easier to feed rice bran.
Right. And how about grape oil?
Grape oil, grape seed oil.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a very expensive oil. Usually it's cold pressed.
Right.
So it's got other nutrients. It's a lot higher in vitamin E than some of your the processed oils. It's got other, if you can afford to give your horse grapeseed oil, it would be more adding to the nutrition of the horse rather than just being used. It's too expensive to use as an energy source.
Right.
Because when you're talking about using oil as an energy source, we're talking like adding a quarter of a cup, a half a cup, a cup.
Yeah.
A day to their feed.
At the same time, I'm kind of thinking about palatability.
And all the studies I've seen on palatability of oils, I've never seen one that included grapeseed oil.
Okay.
What is grapeseed oil?
What about wheat germ?
Wheat germ oil, yeah, again, high in vitamin E. You have to be a little bit careful with wheat germ oil because if you read the bottle, sometimes they add a lot of vitamin A and they add vitamins to it. I mean, it's naturally high in some vitamin A, but they might add more. So it's not something you're going to want to feed a half a cup to or a cup of that either because it might be really high. And the vitamin E is not a problem, but the vitamin A, yeah, you don't want to go excessive on vitamin A because that is one of the fat-soluble vitamins that can be toxic in excessive amounts.
And what about vitamin E in performance horses? Lots of people say that, feed almost twice the recommended amount.
Yes, vitamin E, again, is a very safe vitamin, and it's very important. It's an antioxidant for the horse. A horse that's working hard, particularly like an endurance horse where there's a lot of muscle, the muscle is being used a lot. I mean, it's being used for long distances, many hours in the day. You probably could see a benefit to having the antioxidant action of vitamin E in these animals. And so the normal recommendations, I believe, are under 1,000 international units a day. And for a hard-working horse, you'd probably want to see 2,000, anywhere up to 5,000 international units. Of that. Now, vitamin E is an interesting vitamin in that you have synthetic and you have natural vitamin E. And some recent studies on the natural vitamin E showed that it was absorbed much better than the synthetic. And a lot of these recommendations for high levels, like 2,000 to 5,000 IUs of vitamin E, come from studies that were done with synthetic. So if we were feeding natural vitamin E, you might be okay with 1,000 IUs a day.
Is there any way to tell from labeling which is natural and which is synthetic?
Yes. If it doesn't say it on the bottle, like you can buy human capsules vitamin E, and it may say natural or it may not. But if you look at the ingredients, the D alpha tocopherol, it'll have like the letter D-alpha-tocopherol, or it'll have DL dash alpha tocopherol. And the D is the natural, and the DL is the synthetic.
Aha. Thank you. And it's the D alpha, and I missed the word. If you could possibly give us at least an approximate spelling.
Oh, alpha tocopherol. Okay. So the natural would be D dash A-L-P-H-A, that's alpha, okay, and then tocopherol is T-O-C-O-P-H-E-R-O-L, tocopherol.
Okay, thank you.
And so the other, and then the synthetic is D-L.
Right.
D what? I'm sorry.
L as in Larry. So D.
Okay.
Yeah. Or left.
Would you like to supplement with vitamin E and selenium?
Selenium, again, is also important for muscle. It's an antioxidant, has an antioxidant effect. This, the East Coast is typically, the forages from this part of the country are usually pretty low in selenium, if not deficient. And, a vitamin E and selenium supplement would be good. It may not be necessary if you're feeding a commercial concentrate with enough selenium in it already. How you know whether you're getting enough, well, you might be able, it might have it on the label how much they have, but the biggest thing is if you're feeding enough of the recommended feeding rate for that feed, you may be getting enough selenium. If not, I mean, it doesn't, selenium is one of those that is pretty toxic in small amounts. And so you do have to be a little bit careful with selenium. But if you're feeding an additional supplement to whatever your regular daily ration is, if it's not more than 1 milligram a day or at most 2 milligrams a day, you're probably fine. Some of the supplements come together, vitamin E and selenium. So look for one that gives you the most E for the...
What about selenium yeast versus the inorganic selenium?
The selenium yeast is better, not only better absorbed, but it's been found to be better utilized.
It's less toxic also, isn't it? Haven't some of the studies shown that the inorganic, it causes more toxicity than the organic yeast?
I've just seen that it's better absorbed and better utilized. I mean, selenium even... there are certain plants that are selenium accumulators, and you find a lot of those in the farther west than the East Coast. But those can be pretty toxic too, and so I don't know that selenium yeast would be any safer. Selenium in large amounts is toxic no matter what, whether it's yeast or inorganic. Inorganic, I think you have more of a problem of it not being absorbed than becoming, or it's not used, I mean, it's not absorbed as well, so.
When you say it's not absorbed, is that a pass-through non-absorption, or is that?
Yeah, like in the mouth and out the other end.
Yeah.
So if you're going to test for both toxicity and deficiency, would you use a hair analysis or a blood test?
For selenium, I would use a blood test.
Okay.
That's the one. I mean, blood tests are pretty good for some things. They're, for nutrition, specific nutrients, it's a little bit hard because the body regulates some nutrients. But selenium is one that does work pretty well. To look for deficiency or toxicity.
For one time, I called the Purina plant, and I asked them if they acclimated their selenium content according to the country side or to the area of the country that they were selling their products, and they said they did. It says, so the Purina product in California is different than the Purina product in Ohio.
Well, it would be. It's very smart of them to do it that way. Most like the regional feed companies, certainly do that because they're going to try to match their feeds to what the area needs.
How would you know if your horse is getting from just a an observation if he's getting too much selenium or not enough selenium?
Too much selenium, you'll see it in well hooves that. Has anybody heard that that General Custer actually died of selenium poisoning, selenium toxicity?
What? I didn't hear that.
Has anybody ever heard that General Custer actually died of selenium toxicity?
No. General Custer?
Yeah.
I thought he was old yellow knives or whatever his name is.
Well, what happened was he was waiting for the reinforcements to come, and they were all coming via mule train. And the mules in that mule train couldn't make it. They all went, but most of them went lame because they had selenium toxicity. So indirectly, he sort of died of selenium toxicity. So what it does is it affects the hoof. So lameness, sloughing of the hoof wall is the ultimate sign of toxicity for selenium.
Huh. What are you calling toxic?
Toxic?
Yeah, at what threshold? Blood threshold. I mean, I know normal is somewhere around 150, 130 to 150 when you blood test it. In endurance horses, I know Susan Garlinghouse has written several articles about pushing selenium up to 250 in the blood when you're blood testing. From a nutritional standpoint, what are you, I mean...
Okay, well, actually,
like
I can...
When you're doing a blood test.
A blood test?
Yeah.
I have to think back to... I did a lot of blood tests on selenium. You have two ways of looking at it. You have whole blood, and then you have serum selenium.
Okay.
There may be different numbers from whether it's whole blood or if it's serum.
Serum, I think the reference range is 120 to 180.
180. So toxicity would be then well above that 180.
So 250 is an acceptable range then.
It must be.
Okay.
And as for feeding, I mean, if you're going to look at it, so the horse's requirement is 2 milligrams a day. You could probably get into toxicity situations if starting at around 10 times that. So instead of 2, 20, if the horse was getting 20 milligrams a day.
Is there any benefit to being on the high end of the selenium range versus the low end of the selenium range, say, in endurance?
Thinking about the type of work that these animals do, I think you probably are better off at the high end of the range, so that it works also in concert with vitamin E. So selenium and vitamin E. Again, I've never seen a diet that had 20 milligrams of selenium, but I think you could easily get up to 6 or 8 milligrams of selenium a day when you're putting all the things together that the horse is getting. So the little bit that's getting from the forage, whatever it's getting from its grain concentrate, or maybe another supplement. I think you're absolutely fine with something like that. Some horses, there actually is quite a variability in the ability of each horse to absorb selenium. And so I've known of one horse that, in particular, that they were feeding that horse 6 milligrams a day in order to get a rise in the blood value. I mean,
okay.
To see it have an effect on that horse.
So,
while another horse, you could be giving them 1 or 2 milligrams a day, and you might see the effect of improved blood levels.
So testing a single horse in a herd doesn't necessarily tell you what everybody in the herd's got.
Right. Yeah, it's a very individual thing.
That's sort of depressing.
Yeah.
It's an expensive test to do, and they only do it at, like, two places in the United States.
Right, like Michigan is one.
Michigan State, yeah, is one, and I'm not sure where the other one is. That's where mine go to, but it's like $80 or $90 for that one test.
Yeah, it's
hugely expensive.
So if you suspect that there might be a problem, I mean, things that you might see with selenium deficiency, maybe they have, the horse might have trouble with immune function, so just not able, just get sick easier than other horses, things like that. Then maybe that would be the horse that you would test for selenium.
But not necessarily hoof cracks or something like that. That's not a sign of...
of selenium deficiency? No. No. Yeah. And hoof cracks, there's quite a number of things. Confirmation, diet, so protein in the diet, enough zinc, copper in the diet. Yeah, if you can look at nutrition, those would be selenium... selenium toxicity probably wouldn't be causing hoof cracks.
Okay.
And Deborah, we didn't really, I think we've sort of gone through your vitamin E, selenium, and maybe a bit on protein, but you also talked about vitamin C and alfalfa. And...
okay, and alfalfa and bee pulp and corn. Okay, should we talk about vitamin C then for a minute?
Sounds good.
Okay. Vitamin C, horses are different from humans when it comes to vitamin C. And humans, we can get scurvy from vitamin C deficiency. But a horse doesn't get scurvy. And that's because if the horse has, actually has a certain enzyme in his liver that can convert glucose to vitamin C. So they, in most circumstances, can produce enough vitamin C to meet their requirements. That's if everything's working normally in the horse. So where we see where vitamin C might be beneficial, vitamin C is important, again, for immune function. If they don't have enough vitamin C, they might... it might have... more infections or, you know, not heal quickly or they can't tolerate exercise or stress as well. The studies that have been done in vitamin C, I know there's a couple on weanlings, and they looked at the vitamin C levels in the blood when you wean horses with under different circumstances, and they found that actually the vitamin C was pretty low in the blood during these weanings. So what you see is that stressful times, you might see a drop in vitamin C levels in the horse's blood, and maybe the horse can't make enough vitamin C at that time to provide a complete requirement. I mean, it doesn't shut down production of vitamin C, but maybe the horse might actually benefit from a little extra during stressful times. So that's kind of how we go about making recommendations on vitamin C supplementation, is if the horse is under stress for some reason, that might be the time if this horse is sick, that might be the time to give some vitamin C.
Now, my idea of vitamin C is orange juice. I don't think that's...
there's again, different forms of vitamin C that you can give to the horse. The ester C, I don't know if anybody's ever heard of it. They have it for humans, and they also have it for horses. Vitamin C, because the horse can make its own vitamin C, it doesn't absorb external vitamin C very well. So you really have to give large amounts. I mean, instead of just milligrams, we're talking grams of vitamin C for horses in order to get them to absorb something. We're looking at sometimes 5 grams a day of vitamin C.
Kathleen, this is Dinah. What do you think about the study, from what I understand of it, that Sally Ralston did on shipping horses and vitamin C?
Yes, again, that's a stressful time. And she found that they their blood levels dropped, if I remember correctly. Again, and older horses, senior horses, she found a benefit of supplementing vitamin C in conjunction when they were giving their vaccination.
Is there something to do with how long one supplements a greater amount of vitamin C that has benefit or drawback?
There's probably would be a waste of money to supplement it all the time, because the horses, they're not going to, from what I've seen, they don't really absorb it very well, and then they won't absorb it if they don't need it. So if their own body's producing enough, they're not even going to absorb these high levels. So the only time that is probably beneficial, both for the horse and for your pocketbook, is to be giving it to them when they might be under times of stress or sick.
I guess I got two questions, because endurance horses are stressed a great deal of the time, but also with senior horses, would you just keep them on it? Because someone had suggested to me that for arthritic-type conditions, it helps with the inflammation, or maybe it helps with the autoimmune part of it. I don't know.
Probably the autoimmune part. There's also things that they say that it might help with keep something from premature aging or cancer and health problems like this human. But horses, you don't have to worry about premature aging. They age much faster than we do. Like that. Now I've forgotten actually what the question was.
Would there be some cases like endurance horses that are under a heavy competition shipping schedule, or a very senior horse with some kind of arthritic condition, where you just keep them on it as a supplement, or you don't think that's worthwhile?
Well, I think if you, for the endurance horses, it may be something you bring up and down in the diet. There's no harm to something like vitamin C increasing and decreasing that. So if you're getting, ready for, let's say you have a competition in 3 weeks, so maybe you may not need it up till, start giving it 2 days before you ship the horse to the competition, and then give it to the horse through the competition, and then a couple days when you come back, after you come home. And then you can wean it out of the diet, and then as you get ready for the next competition, bring it back in. So it's something you could bring up and down, for vitamin C. For these senior horses, it may help them if they are having troubles with frequent infections or problems with wound healing and things like that, or their joint health. Well, death, ligament problems, tendon problems. Yes, if you want to put the money into giving the older horse the vitamin C, it may help.
Okay.
Any particular form of vitamin C that you recommend? Pills and grind it up in the quantity you're talking about? Or?
Yeah, well, the ester C is a good
one. Ester C?
Yeah.
Whatever people want to cover, this is what people think is important.
Okay, so any other questions on vitamin C?
Nothing. So.
Okay, should we move on to alfalfa?
Yeah.
Okay. Alfalfa is, I think, a little bit of a difficult one for the endurance horse, because it's good for them in some ways and maybe not so good for them in other ways. Alfalfa, the difference between alfalfa and regular grass haze is alfalfa is higher in protein, but it's higher in calcium and higher, so protein, calcium, and those would be the things that we would look at for endurance horses. Calcium, I think there's been recent studies that showed that horses that had problems with ulcers, that they had developed fewer ulcers when they were on a diet with alfalfa, and that was because of the buffering capacity of the calcium. We all know that when a horse is at an endurance ride and competing, they like the taste of alfalfa, and so they're going to eat better when they're competing. And maybe that calcium also during that competition is helping, you know, soothe that stomach a little bit too. So, yeah, alfalfa is good for certain times. The bad side of alfalfa is if it's fed all the time. And now horses in different parts of the country, I mean, that's all they have is alfalfa. Here on the East Coast, we have a luxury of having a choice. There have been a couple of cases where horses that were on a strictly alfalfa diet, they had problems with calcium regulation. And the theory behind it was that when the horse is working hard, sometimes they have to mobilize calcium out of the stores of calcium in the body, some of those being in bones. And if a horse has a diet that's really high in calcium all the time, that the system for mobilizing that calcium when it's needed at a certain time, it becomes lazy and doesn't turn on when it needs to. And so the horse might have a little bit of a metabolic problem during a ride. I know of one horse in particular that the rider had that problem, and then when she started giving the horse grass hay instead of alfalfa hay, the metabolic problem went away. So it's probably not something you see with every single horse, because there are certainly horses out west that have alfalfa, endurance horses that have alfalfa and compete on alfalfa and do fine. But there are horses that do have a little bit of a problem probably with that calcium. A little bit of alfalfa in the horse's diet all the time probably is not harmful, particularly if you're going to be feeding a lot at a ride. Having some in the diet is maybe a good thing, so that it's not such a shock to the body, to their digestive tract when you get to the ride and you're getting a lot more alfalfa. The high protein, we talked a little bit earlier about how high protein was detrimental to performance. But then I haven't seen any specific studies that showed that the protein alfalfa was bad for performance of an endurance horse.
What's the ideal protein level in the diet?
The ideal protein level depends on what your horse is, if it's a growing horse. But an endurance horse is probably around 12% of the total diet. So somewhere between 10 and 12. And alfalfa hay typically has around 16-18% protein. A mixed grass hay, probably find around 12-14% protein. And some grass hays are like 5-12% protein. So you see, if you had like a Timothy alfalfa mix, you know, the Timothy being 5% protein and the alfalfa the 18%, it might be a good combination, so you end up with a protein in that seed somewhere around 10-12%.
This isn't easy.
I don't know if this question's on the agenda, so you can just not answer it if you want, but for a long time I fed corn, oats, and barley because I thought that was the most balanced thing. I maybe came from Joyce Harmon or somebody. And then recently a bunch of people said to me that corn is not a good idea.
Oh, that's actually on the agenda. Okay.
Okay.
And did when people said it's not a good idea, did they have any reason that they behind it not being a good idea?
That it's metabolized like sugar, basically, that it's just like a quick energy rush and it's not sustaining, and
okay,
it's too hard on their, you know, insulin levels or something to have this like sugar infusion from the corn.
Okay. There's it's not fair to single corn out for that alone, because oats and barley have the same sort of thing. When a horse digests oats or corn or barley, it's broken down the glucose and then goes into the bloodstreams and you get like a sugar rush. But and there are some interesting things about the differences between oats, corn, and barley in that sugar rush. Oats is probably what we use as a standard for our glycemic response because it has a nice standard response. And then corn, if it's just plain whole corn, it won't have as high of a glycemic response, a standard response. But if you heat treat it, steam flake it, micronize it, put it into a pellet, then it does have a higher glycemic response, more like that of corn, more like that of oats, and it can even be a little higher because corn has more starch, which is the thing that causes the glycemic response, than oats. Barley, it's the same sort of thing as with corn. You don't get that high of a response with just whole barley, but if you heat treat it in a way, roll it, steamroll it, micronize it, then you can get it's better absorbed, but you also get a higher glycemic response. Now, some of that response, I think our endurance horse needs some of that glucose in order to build up their glycogen stores in their muscles. So totally avoiding this corn, oats, and barley is probably not a good idea for these animals. Excessive amounts, well, yes, and you have certain individuals that are more sensitive to them, horses that are insulin resistant, yes, you want to cut out the starches, but a hardworking animal probably can't get enough energy from the fiber energy alone, and so it's going to need some of that starch, that glucose energy. Corn, I read some stuff that was written 100 years ago about corn, and their biggest concern, corn was an easy way to get energy into the animal. A hardworking animal, you could actually feed, you could get enough corn to get the horse enough calories so he didn't lose weight. But their biggest concern with corn was mycotoxins. Some corn was fine, and other corn had a mold that you don't really see on the corn, but it's there. And they would feed that, and the horses would get sick from that. So that was their biggest concern. But most of our feed mills nowadays, they check the corn before they use it in horse feeds, and so the mycotoxin risk is probably a lot lower, of course, depending on the manufacturer.
Steam process like rolled grains or not?
Well, rolling, you can roll it or you can steam roll it.
Okay.
So steaming, it's the heat process, like with corn, that actually makes it more digestible. But just rolling and cracking doesn't improve the starch digestibility that much on corn. Most of the manufacturers, the major manufacturers, when they use corn in their feeds, it's processed in some way so that it is better absorbed.
But that also means more glycemic?
It is, yeah, it means more glycemic if it's better utilized. Now, when, of course, glycemic response is related to other factors than just the amount of starch. Amount of starch is one of the things that causes a glycemic response. The rate of intake. So if you had a pound of corn and then a pound of corn that had been sweetened with molasses or something, if the horse eats it faster, it's going to cause a higher glycemic response. If the horse eats it slower, it's going to have a lower glycemic response. If you have a smaller amount, of course, you're going to have a smaller glycemic response. A larger amount, you can have a larger glycemic response. So there's a lot of different factors that affect glycemic response. If you want to avoid high sugar rushes in your horses, then you feed more frequent meals, smaller, more frequent meals. You can mix your grains with something that slows down the intake. So like in England and Australia, they love to use chaff, which is chopped up forage. Mix it in with the grain, and the horse slows way down on the rate of intake. Glycemic response, again, is it's something maybe to fear if you have, or high glycemic feeds or something to fear if you have a horse that has insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is probably not that prominent in our endurance horses. Once you turn them out and leave them in the pastures and they become pasture potatoes, you're going to see a higher incidence of it because it's fairly common in Arabian horses. And you can see insulin. You can almost see insulin resistance on a horse because these horses that tend to get real crusty necks and that bubbly fat. Those are the ones that they've seen are more insulin resistant.
What about? I'm reading a book that was written about 150 years ago that praises the barley, but it's the horses of the Sahara, so it also may be the only grain they had access to. I don't know.
Yeah. Why do they praise it? Well, and barley was very commonly fed in Europe. I mean, England and France. And again, it's an energy source. It's high glycemic. If it's been like some of the old timers, they boiled the barley. And the horse could actually get more energy out of it once it's been boiled because it improved the glycemic, it improved the digestibility of the starches in the barley.
So I guess I'm sort of unclear on whether you would recommend that corn, oats, and barley are a balanced ration and whether it's better for it to be steam processed or not.
Okay. I am a fan of getting your money's worth. So I think that if I don't have any problem with any of the grains, corn, oats, or barley, if they're being used as an energy source, and the horse does not have a problem with insulin resistance. So, yes, I would recommend feeding it. I think endurance horses, particularly hardworking ones, need some source, like some type of grain in their diet. I do think that processing them so they're more available, you're getting your money's worth out of it. If you're feeding it and then you're seeing it come out, most of it coming out the other end, I mean, then you're throwing waste. So when you heat process your barley and your corn, you're going to get more out of it. The old oats, the starch in oats is very digestible. I mean, the old timers, the horse need oats, and that's why they fed it. And there was something to that because the starches in there in the oats are more available to the horse. I don't think you need to feed excessive quantities. It should be enough to maintain the weight of the horse for the amount of work that he's doing. I think you can vary it within a range, a safe range, to tailor the amount of grain that you're feeding to the amount of work the horse has done in the day. We're not talking extremes because you don't want the horse to colic from extreme changes in the diet, but let's say your horse only gets ridden twice a week. On the days he's not being ridden, maybe you're only feeding 1 pound. And then on days that he's getting ridden, maybe he gets 4 pounds or 3 pounds, something like that. So you're matching the amount of energy you're feeding to the horse to the amount the horse is using. The one thing that about just like the Harmony mix, the corn, oats, and barley, was it wasn't fortified. And so it's strictly an energy source. Those are strictly energy sources for the horse. It doesn't really add balance to anything else but energy in the diet. So I am a fan of commercial concentrates because they've added vitamins and minerals to the feed. So there's zinc and copper and calcium and phosphorus and selenium and vitamin E and vitamin A and vitamin C and most of them don't have vitamin C. Sorry, B vitamins. So yeah, I am a fan of commercial feeds also. If you are feeding just straight corn, oats, and barley and hay, I think that you should look into finding some kind of vitamin mineral supplement to balance, or a balancer. A lot of females make a type of a ration balancer or a balance. I'm trying to think of other names for what they might call it, but it's a protein, vitamin, mineral supplement that can be added to a straight grain diet to balance it out. Does that answer your question?
I think so. I had something called ABC Plus.
ABC Plus, unfortunately, I think some of their advertising is a little bit misleading because it's a good digestive aid. It maybe, you know, helps the microbes do their job, and maybe it helps the enzymes do their job so that the horse can break down and absorb the food better. But it does. They don't have the supplemental. It doesn't really have the supplemental zinc and or enough zinc and copper and that you would find in other, like in a true vitamin mineral supplement.
Okay.
Kathleen.
Yes.
It's Dinah. A quick question about chromium.
Uh huh.
In some states, it's a regulated veterinary dispensed item. I'm wondering why.
Why? we have a silly a system in this country when it comes to different nutrients and or different feed ingredients. And it's a way of regulating what you can put in animal feeds and not. And for some reason you can add chromium to, you can give chromium to humans, and you can now give chromium to pigs, but it's not approved to give chromium to horses. So, and nobody's gone through the trouble to get this. It's the American Association of Feed Control Officials to add chromium to their list of approved feed additives or feed ingredients to their list. And that's
okay. So it's silly. Okay, got it.
It's in some supplements, isn't it?
I'm sorry, what's that?
You can find some supplements that have it in it.
Yeah, you can. And then in fact, I know of a friend of mine makes a supplement that has chromium in. But if the FDA, if people had adverse reactions to it, they could put a complaint into the FDA, and the FDA would they could go after them. People, the manufacturers that use the products in the feed, but you need to have adverse reactions. And as of yet, I have never seen a horse have an adverse reaction to chromium.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they don't go after them. It's just the FDA is overwhelmed with too much, and they don't have time to go after small supplement manufacturers who put unimproved ingredients into their feeds. And something like that, it's kind of silly because it's oversight, because there's nothing wrong with putting chromium in horses' diets. So. Does that answer your question?
Helps with glucose metabolism, or?
Supposedly, does it help with glucose metabolism? There was one study that showed an improvement in performance, lower lactate in the horse in an exercise bout with chromium. The hopes that it would help humans with insulin problems. I don't think that's really panned out. It hasn't panned out to be the panacea that people had hoped that chromium would be.
Okay.
I've got a question too after you finish, Doug.
Okay, Kathleen. You said one of the reasons you favor the good quality feeds is that the feed companies add supplements. What are they assuming the horse would typically be getting a day? Because, like, our Arabs are getting less than 2 pounds a day. So are they getting enough supplements in that amount?
Probably not. If you look on the feed tag, or the bag. Some manufacturers put it on the bag. Some people put it on the feed tag. They'll put, like, their recommended amount. And if you're feeding less than that recommended amount, then, no, the horse wouldn't be getting what that manufacturer is desiring your horse to get it. So let's say you have a feed that the recommended feeding rate is 4 pounds a day and, for a 1,000-pound horse. And you have your 1,000-pound one, which is a big Arab. But let's say you had a 1,000-pound Arab, but he was doing fine weight-wise with just 2 pounds a day. So if you're only giving half of what they're recommending, you're only getting half of the zinc and the copper and the selenium that that they would be hoping, the manufacturer would be hoping that you would get. So then in those cases, you need to you need to top that diet off with some kind of ration balance, some balancer, or a vitamin mineral supplement.
Okay, good. Cheryl, go ahead.
I've got a sort of a rat hole, so if Stike's got something quick, we ought to hit Stike's first.
Well, mine's probably, my other topic is what order do you feed feeds in particularly? So when and what order it rides, so that's probably a long topic, won't you?
Anyhow, the thing I was going for was I've always heard about the calcium-phosphorus ratio and thinking in terms of the corn oats barley part as well. How does that play versus the calphos ratio?
That's actually a good point.
And then the other thing is something we heard recently talked in terms of omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acids, and I think it's the omega-3s being good and the omega-6s being perhaps less than wonderful, and corn oats and barley having different characteristics there versus some other types of grain substances, and maybe we should be leery about the conventional grains on that basis. I don't know.
Okay. Okay. Well, first, we'll go to the first half of your question about the calcium and phosphorus. Okay. The horse needs more calcium in the diet than phosphorus, because when they have more phosphorus in the diet than calcium, then it upsets the balance of the balance in the body for calcium regulation. And so if you have high phosphorus, the horse, has anybody ever heard of big head disease?
No.
Big head, Miller's disease. Well, what happens is the horse starts resorbing bone and then depositing some strange bone in a strange manner on different parts of the body, so one of them being the head. And so these horses that had, it was called Miller's disease because the horses were getting maybe a lot of wheat from the miller, and so they were getting too much phosphorus and not enough calcium, and so they were developing the body was depositing a strange bone in their head. It's called big head or Miller's disease. In this country, we don't see it that often. I have seen it in some abuse cases, but in countries in like South America, it's more common because they have problems with their forage, the calcium availability in their forages. When you feed straight oats, corn, and barley, not a commercial feed, nobody has added any calcium to that feed to bring that high phosphorus content of those grains into balance. When you buy a commercial feed, they add calcium, and that's one of the main things they do, is bring the calcium-phosphorus ratio back to normal so that there's more calcium than phosphorus in that feed. If you're feeding with a grass hay, it can be an issue if you have a lot of phosphorus in your grain and then just a grass hay, which has maybe a normal amount of calcium. If you're feeding with alfalfa, it's probably not an issue because alfalfa is high in calcium. Does that answer that question?
Yeah.
Okay. The same thing goes for wheat bran. Wheat bran is high in phosphorus and very low in calcium. Rice bran, on the other hand, it has the same problem, but most of the commercial rice brands, stabilized rice brands that you find on the market, have added calcium. And if they don't, look for that. You want a rice bran that has added calcium. But you're not going to find wheat bran with added calcium, because it's usually just a byproduct that they sell just by itself. So if you're feeding a lot of bran mashes, it's something to think about. You know, if you're feeding a bran mash, either add calcium or feed it with alfalfa. They don't run into problems that way. The second thing was the omega-6s and omega-3 fatty acids.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Grains are high in omega-6 fatty acids. Omega-6 fatty acids are what we call pro-inflammatory fatty acids, and then omega-3 fatty acids are high in things like flax, linseed, and they are anti-inflammatory fatty acids. So if you have a horse just out on grass, there's a lot of omega-3s in pasture, and it's a nice balance of omega-3s and omega-6 with just grass. And so these horses don't have a lot of, they have a nice balance, so they have a balance of anti-inflammatories and pro-inflammatories working well in their system. When you add straight grains to a hay diet, let's say if you had oats and hay, you're going to have a diet pretty high in omega-6 fatty acids and kind of not as high in soda, a little bit out of balance there. If you have a commercial concentrate with added fat, if the manufacturer is using corn oil in that added fat, the corn oil is really high in omega-6 fatty acids. So if you had a hay and grain with corn oil diet, you're going to have a really out-of-balance diet of omega-6 pro-inflammatory. If you have a commercial concentrate that uses soybean oil is lower in omega-6s and has more omega-3 fatty acids, it's going to help bring that concentrate fatty acid profile back a little bit into better balance, so that if you had your hay, your grain with soy oil is a better thing. If you're feeding straight grains and you're adding your own oil, if you add canola, again, higher in omega-3s, lower in omega-6s, that helps to bring things back into balance. And then if you add a little bit of flax oil to any of these diets, that helps, because the flax oil is really high, or flaxseed is really high in omega-3 fatty acids. So that balances things out even better. Does that answer that question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, doesn't flaxseed have to be ground to be really available? And someone used to tell me to soak it, and someone else told me that was toxic.
Flax is probably the most confusing of all. The old time flax, it was pretty high in, if it got wet or if you ground it and left it exposed to air, it would start producing cyanide.
Oh.
And yeah, so it in large amounts it could be toxic. What the flax producers, growers have done is they've tried to breed a bit of that that out of the flax so that it doesn't produce as much cyanide. I mean, it's not totally gone, but it does produce a much smaller amount of cyanide. So ground flax, I've tried to look to see if I could find a truly stabilized ground flax, and I'm not sure if it really truly exists. But there are different opinions. But if you feed a horse whole flax, and the horse can grind the flax with its teeth, it's probably the best way to get those omega-3s into that horse, because you haven't cracked open that grain yet to expose it to air and produce cyanide, and also losing the omega-3 fatty acids. The old-timers, what they would do with flax is they would boil it, and they would drop it into boiling water, and that would denature that enzyme that's causing the cyanide production. And so they would feed that nice linseed gel, that linseed goo, to horses, and it was a nice safe way. But it's a lot of work to have to do that. When you feed whole flaxseed to a horse, you can feed it without grinding it or cracking it, but you will see some of the seeds coming out the other end, and it can be kind of messy because, I don't know, sometimes it sticks to their tongues and they lick the walls and you see flax seeds everywhere. Has anybody ever fed whole flax seed?
Yes, it seems to come out the other end.
Yeah, it seems to come out the other end. Some of it is being broken down and absorbed. It depends on how well they chew or crack them with their teeth. So there are some commercial flax supplements that are probably the ones that are stabilized. That may be, that is ground flax. I don't know that they've actually done tests to see how well the omegas have lasted through that grinding and stabilizing process. But even if you are feeding something like that, you will see an improvement in coats. So I'm assuming at least something in there is helping these horses.
Okay, because probably the most expensive way to feed it would be to either buy, obviously, the cold-pressed flax oil or to buy Platinum Performance. But, I mean, that's ground, so I don't know how much is really in there after a while, and it's very costly.
It is very costly, and, again, you do see a lot of people see an improvement in coat with the Platinum Performance, and I think that's why they keep feeding it and paying that high price. But whether it's actually delivering omega-3s, I don't think we know.
Does it decrease the coat's likelihood of being covered with mud?
I don't know of anything that does that except the blankets.
It doesn't make it fall off. It's not worth it.
Kathleen, what I keep changing this, but I've read, traditionally they said, feed the hay and then they concentrate. I read an article by Gail Eckert who actually recommended feed the concentrate, let them wait for a while, and then feed the forage. So that's one question. The other question is, when would you feed their last grain before the competition, particularly if you've got to do 100 where you're concerned about having enough energy to get them through the entire day?
Yeah. KER has done a lot of experiments in these sort of questions. The study, one study they did when they looked at what happens when you feed the grain first and then the hay, or the hay first and then the grain. What they found is if you fed the grain and then you turned around and fed hay right behind it, the hay tended to push the grain through the digestive tract quicker, so it wasn't so the horse wasn't getting as much out of that concentrate as it could have. When they waited 2 hours to feed the hay after the grain, then the horse got more out of the grain.
But you're talking, it's not a matter of waiting 10 minutes, it's a matter of waiting.
It was 2 hours. Well, in that particular study, they did 2 hours. I think it's a little bit difficult because you can look at it like whether you want the horse to get as much as possible out of that grain, or you want to keep that horse's digestive tract as healthy as possible. I mean, I like the idea of mixing the grain in with the forage, and perhaps that forage is pushing the grain through a little bit faster, but it slows the rate that the horse actually eats the food. So, like they do in Australia, mixing it in with chaff and or some kind of chopped forage.
Oh, okay. So you're saying in the feed tub you would mix the grain and the forage together.
Yeah, and that slows the rate that they're eating it. So hopefully that it would slow the rate of passage down.
And how about in terms of timing? I used to get up and feed like 3.5 to 4 hours before 100, and then somebody said, that's wonderful, you're going to make sure they have their spike right at the start of the ride.
Yeah, that was also some work that KR had done. They found that when you fed be fed, well, we think back to that glycemic response a little bit when you feed grain, and then you're going to get a glycemic response.
Right.
That glycemic response peaks about 2 hours after you feed the grain. So if a horse starts exercising within those, that at about that 2 hours after you fed the grain, the body's going to be in trying to take the glucose out of the blood. It'll have released insulin, and the insulin's going to be trying to take the glucose out of the blood and tuck it away for storage. And then they start exercising and needing that glucose, and the insulin's already high, so you're going to have a drop in glucose so that it's it actually goes below the resting levels if you did something like that. So the recommendation was not feeding them within at least 3 hours of starting exercise. So you wouldn't want them to get their grain within 3 hours.
Now, how about like
an hour.
An hour or so that they, you know.
So they aren't spiking yet. A half hour actually would be even better.
Yeah, so in other words, fairly close, particularly not feeding them a lot, maybe.
Yeah, if you're just giving them a pound or something.
Yeah,
like that.
3/4 of a pound or so that they get the energy, you know, partway into the body. That does make sense then?
Yeah, that makes sense. So like, yeah, between a half hour and an hour before, but no longer than that.
Okay, and then that's very similar to what we do at Holds, in effect.
Uh-huh, that's true, yeah, because then once they start the exercising, then since the insulin isn't high yet, you know, those hormones of exercise take over, and they'll keep the blood glucose level hopefully normal.
Does anybody else have any other questions? I think we've...
The beet pulp part?
Okay, what's beet pulp? Yeah. Beet pulp is it's the byproduct of the sugar beet industry. It's when they extract the sugar out of the beet pulp is like a big beet, and then they could squeeze all the sugar out, and then what's left is this fibrous stuff that they can dehydrate, and it makes very good horse feed and cattle feed, and I think they might even feed it to pigs, but it's mostly digestible fiber, and so it's been used in horse feeds or horse rations because of that fiber. When a horse can get energy from hay, it's because it's got microbes that are breaking down the fiber for hay. I mean for energy. The beet pulp, the microbes can break down the fiber there and use it for energy. I am a beet pulp fan. I think it's a good way to get some. I mean, I wouldn't put a horse on beet pulp entirely unless there were extreme circumstances. But as an addition to the diet, adding some beet pulp into the diet, particularly an endurance horse, I think it's a nice way to get more calories into the horse. In kind of a safe way because it's fiber energy. It's helping the microbes. There's differences in beet pulp. You can get beet pulp with added molasses, and you can get beet pulp that doesn't have added molasses. You can get pelleted beet pulp. You can get flaked beet pulp, and you can just get regular beet pulp shreds. If you have an insulin-resistant horse, then you have to worry about that extra molasses in the beet pulp. Or if you have you can even just the regular shreds, if you have an insulin-resistant horse, you might have to rinse those beet pulp shreds just to get all the residual sugar out. But for a hardworking animal, an endurance horse, I think that residual sugar is not as much an issue. It's it'll give them some energy also.
Do you find horses find the beet pulp to be palatable? At rides, mine very consistently turn their noses up.
Yeah, I think that's one of those there's two things that they kind of go off of or get go away from, don't like so much at Ride. One is oil, fat. They tend to kind of go away from that and not want it. And then and beet pulp is one of those things, too. Mm-hmm. The more they're used to it in their diet, if it's something they're being fed all the time, the less likely. I think that's one of those things. And then they might want something that's strictly grain over something with beet pulp in it.
Okay, so it's not my imagination.
No. Any questions? Other questions about beet pulp?
Any other questions?
It has to be soaked, obviously, or it's better to soak it?
I prefer, I mean, I'd like to see it soaked, particularly the pelleted. The horses can choke on the beet pulp when it's pelleted and you don't soak it. They did a lot of studies at the University of California with just regular beet pulp shreds, unsoaked and everything, and they swore up and down they never had a problem with a horse choking on it. But I think just to be safe, I like to see it soaked. There's a newer product, beet pulp flakes. They soak up in like 15 minutes. They're great. I mean, you just add the water to it, and it's ready, basically. I mean, you add warm water, and it's ready even quicker. But the thing about soaking them, you don't want to soak it too long. If you leave it, like, for 24 hours, sometimes it may start fermenting and go off. But if you're in a hurry, you can throw hot water over beet pulp in it, regular like shreds or the pellets, and it could be ready in half hour, 15 minutes, half hour. If you get a commercial feed that has beet pulp in it, usually there's enough oil and molasses on it so that they don't tend to choke. But there are certain horses that if they eat too quick, if they're bolters, They there's a chance they could choke. But with the commercial feeds with beet pulp in it, you don't want to soak those out that hour. You just want to put it in the feed bin and maybe pour a little water over it if you're worried about it, and give it to them right straight away. It doesn't need to soak for a while.
I have a different question. I don't know if I can answer this. A horse that's had lameness is just connected to bone issues, avascular necrosis and a broken coffin bone. Is there anything you can do to support bone strength through nutrition?
Yes, there's a couple of supplements on the market now. And in fact, there's a new one that's kind of interesting because when a horse goes in, is on layup and doesn't have turnout, they actually start to lose bone density.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a supplement called, hold on a second. Now, this supplement they have found that actually increases bone density in horses that are don't have turnout, not being worked at all. And Durup. It is a KER product.
Mm-hmm.
Duraplex is the name of the product.
Duraplex?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
And if anybody is interested, just can go to KER.com
mm-hmm.
and then look under the supplement called Duraplex.
Great.
Speaking about KER and supplements and stuff like that, does KER distribute things only through distributors, or can common garden variety people like me go to their website and order?
You can go to their web. I think most of them, they have a new line of KER X, which is, I think it's supposed to be distributed through veterinarians. But right at the moment, I believe you can go to the website and get it directly. like they have a hung-up buffer called EquiSure. There's Kentucky Equine Research had a, I think it was about 5 years ago, 6 years ago maybe, the owner and his wife split. And so they had a line of supplements that was called Kentucky Performance Products. And that was the Enduramax and Nalox and Caraform and MyoGuard. And when the owner and his wife split, the wife got the supplement side, and Joe Pagan got the feed mill part of Kentucky Equine Research and the research farm. And the wife, she took Kentucky Performance Products, so she continued selling the MyoGuard and the Caraform and Enduramax and all of that. And KR didn't make supplements for a while until they have, I guess, the non-compete expired. And so now KR has a line of supplements. Actually, they were able to have supplements that were not similar to what Kentucky Performance Products had. So like a hoof supplement, they couldn't have a hoof supplement, and they couldn't have a Nalox supplement. But now the non-compete's over, so they can start having those supplements. But they had some unique products like that Duraflex, that bone.
I just found it under the KERX, so that means I can't order it on my own?
If you look at the bottom, it says buy online. I'm online right now.
And it says buy online.
Oh, I
yeah.
See.
And can you check EquiSure and see if you see EquiSure?
Yep, it says buy online right by it.
Okay, so at the moment they are available.
And what's EquiSure for?
EquiSure is an interesting product. It is a hind gut buffer.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a horse that's on a really high grain diet, you have a problem. Let's say a racehorse, not an endurance horse, but a racehorse. They're getting 15 pounds of grain a day and maybe only 10 pounds of hay. That grain has a strong influence on the pH of the hindgut, so the large intestine and the cecum, and drives it down to where it's not healthy. And so this product EquiSure is it helps to balance out bring the pH back up of the hindgut to where it should be, like if a horse is on a normal forage diet. I'm not quite sure where that would fit into the endurance horse. We have tried it a little bit, particularly when the horse was being shipped, and it seemed to actually help the horse through shipping. It's a coated bicarbonate that's coated that makes it all the way through the digestive tract into the hindgut before it actually starts having its effect on the pH.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could probably go on all night at the rate we're going.
No doubt.
And I had a suspicion that this would be a really good topic to have, and I think we've sort of proven that, if only to me. And I want to thank Kathleen.
You're welcome. My pleasure. And if you want to do this again another time, that's fine also.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe in about 4 months or so do it again would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be fine.
Just so that we can have absorbed this, be halfway through the ride season in our panic mode.
Yeah. That's when the good questions come out.
Okay. I want to thank Kathleen enormously, as I say. And I'm going to go back to Ann Ayala. Ann, I know this is getting late for you as well as everybody else on the call.
Okay.
My druthers on the FEI part would be to have a separate call on FEI stuff.
Maybe I could just say a couple of things for those people who are interested in – can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Might be interested in trying out for one of the zone teams for the championship in September because it's coming up close. And let me just say, if you are interested, these are the things that you need to do. You need to file an application to be on the ranking rider list if you are not already there. And you do that by going to the USEF website, working your way down through documents, disciplines, endurance, and ranking packet, which is the last thing. It's rather lengthy, but it will tell you everything you need to know. I think it costs $50 to put your name on the list. And if you are thinking about trying to participate in that, that or the WEG, as far as that's concerned, for the following year, it would be wise to go ahead and get on the list, because only the only rides that count for points are the ones that you have after you have put your name on the list. And the teams will be chosen by invitation from each zone from the ranked riders list. And what gets you points on there? You are ranked by the two best scores that you have from the time you join, i.e. send your $50 to USEF, or going back 2 years as long as you have renewed, which is good because it means that new people who want to go on now, if they score well at some upcoming, two or three upcoming rides, you have a good chance of being in the top 6 to 8 in your zone.
Unless you're on the East Coast.
Well, you do have a few more choices. If you've missed Florida, you at this point, well, Cheryl is trying to decide whether to make the ride in Georgia.
I got an email from Cheryl today saying that she has made hers the FEI.
If she can find the people to do it. She's having trouble finding judges.
Yeah, 50, 75, and 100.
Yeah. And then there would be Biltmore, and then there would be Vermont.
Yeah, you've got...
And those would be your choices, because the cutoff is the 1st of August.
Yeah, you've got Fitz to start off.
You have Fitz, yeah, in Florida. So you have that assortment of rides on the East Coast. Now, also, there's another list called the Endurance Standing. And this is a total of all the points you have for all the rides that you do in this AERC year, FEI rides. But it starts with the 1st of December, so the GOSI would have been the first ride that would count. And the person that has the most points at the end of this year receives the Maggie Price Endurance Award from USEF. That's a separate list from the ranked rider list. The ranking rider list only counts your two best scores over a certain period of time, depending on when you join. So you can go back 2 years. If you were on the list last year, you will still be on the list as long as you kept your membership, quote, you renewed your ranking rider dues, as it were, or whatever you want to call it. And then if you want to start now, you still have a number of rides. If you score well, your chances are they're fairly good. I noticed I counted.
The interesting thing is, though, with that, Anna, so Stephanie, is that you don't have to be riding your own horse or the horse that you're nominating.
No, this is rider.
This is
rider only.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if a rider has two or three horses and one of them goes lame, they can take another of their horses.
Or ride somebody else's.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could in theory.
Grab a Rita Swift or
qualify
Valerie Navy.
For your for horse and then go by the world champion and race that one if you could afford it.
Now, for this invitational team championship, North American team championship, it's only a CEI 3. So that means that the most the horse has to have done is a 75-mile ride in order to be eligible.
Yeah.
So if you started, FEI with a 50 now and then you did a 75, that horse would be eligible.
Can I ask a question, Anne? This is Tom Gower.
Yeah, I'll try.
Excuse me?
I'll try.
Okay, for this championship you're talking about as well as the WEG,
right.
I'm under the impression that you're grandfathered in if your horse has a COC within the last 2 years. Is that correct?
Well, it has to be within 2 years of the, not the date of the ride, but the day that the entries have to be submitted. It has to be within that 2 year period. So it will go back further for this September than it will be for the WAG.
Okay.
20 months. There's a 24-month period.
I don't want to monopolize your time. Maybe I could just send you a specifics on me, and could you advise me as to whether I'm interpreting it correctly or not?
Sure.
Okay.
That too.
No,
people may have other questions about FEI and rule changes, but I don't know whether you want to get into that tonight or not. If you do, fine. If not, like you say, we can schedule another call on that topic for those who are interested.
Is it okay with folks who are interested in FEI, and we'll try to do this for the next couple weeks, but just do a focus call on that topic?
That'd be tremendous. This is Tom again.
That's fine. Although, Ann, this is Steph again, I do have a specific question because they're giving rider ranking points now for the 50 and 75-mile CEIs.
That's right.
50% and 75%. How does that fit into the rider ranking list? I mean, somebody could have 800 points but not have two ride scores that are going to beat, you know what I'm saying? They're going to be high enough to beat
somebody who's done 100.
Wow. Yeah, somebody
yeah.
who rides.
And who has best,
so
you know, who's in a,
rides,
or a top three or four of the finishers on a 100-mile ride.
Yeah, can campaign over and over and over again and have enough points than somebody who has maybe just two rides in.
I think they're doing the points for the lower rides as much for the what I call the endurance standings for the Maggie Price award as they are for the actual ranked rider list.
The
I think that's one reason they are given. I'd have to check on whether the philosophy behind that, but I think the reason they list, you know, the points for the 75s and the 50s are not so much in anticipation that somebody with just 50s and 75s will have enough points to be one of the six from the zone, but that they could accumulate conceivably enough, maybe, for the other award.
Which is
the
fourth?
You know, and then there's the way to consider, and it's further down the road.
You have to be on the rider ranking list to get the points.
Mm-hmm.
So the rider ranking list and basically the endurance standing list are one and the same, but they're ranked differently.
They're not really quite the same because, as I understand it, the ranked rider list is listed in order of ranking by your two best scores.
I think. What's,
I mean, you're not off the list just because you've got a low, you know, a 65 instead of a 400 and something. But the endurance standings includes all the points that you have accumulated, no matter what distance.
Yeah, but I think the people on the list are the same people. It's just
well, a lot of times
right.
That's true.
A ranking score for rider at a ranking trial, and yeah.
Yeah, and the points are explained in that document that's on the USEF website. Without going into all that, it tells you what kind of points you earn for what.
Right.
And
you have to be on the rider ranking list, I guess, to be.
But you have to be up for it for anything to count. Either way, you've got to be on the ranking rider list, yeah.
Right.
That is true.
So can I just ask, which was the Georgia ride you said might be FEI now?
Cheryl, you remember what it is. It's Eric Reuter's ride, and it's down near Macon, Georgia. And it's
Red Barn or something?
Third week.
Yeah, Red
Barn.
Red Barn, it's roughly March 26th.
Yeah.
Remember that? It's because March 26th is my birthday.
Oh, yeah, she's got three different rides with three different names on that same weekend up
it's
there.
It's Saturday.
Yeah, the FEI ride is Saturday, and we got email today saying she'd have a 50, 75, and 100.
That's the plan. I talked to her this morning. She was still having trouble finding judges, but I think she probably will work that out. And insofar as I know, the best person to check with is Cheryl Van Dusen on that count, because she is the one that will know.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Let me, as I say.
Does give us one more ride in the east.
Exactly. I'm very happy about this, quite frankly,
yeah.
From a
mm-hmm.
perspective.
I think a lot of people are.
Yeah. Anyhow, I'd like to thank everybody who's on the call. I will set up something probably for, a week out. A week from today, Anne, would you be available?
I think so. I'm away from my calendar right now, but I don't think there's a problem.
Okay. That would be like the 9th.
Yeah, should be fine.
Okay, and I'll shoot an email out saying we'll have a special vis-a-vis FEI for additional questions probably around 8 p.m. on Monday the 9th. So those of us who are on this call who have additional questions and or want to stew on this a bit more, we can. Okay?
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
Glad we're here. Bye.